Welcome to episode 5 of the Olasky Interview. I'm Jill Nelson. Thanks for joining us. Today you'll hear Marvin Olasky's 2012 interview with author and journalist Melanie Kirkpatrick. She's a senior fellow at the Hudson Institute, a former Wall Street Journal editor, and the author of Escape from North Korea, the untold story of Asia's Underground Railroad. And we have Marvin here to give us a little more background. Marvin, hi.
Hi, Jill.
Well, Escape from North Korea was World's Book of the Year in 2013, and I looked back in our archives, and you described Kirkpatrick's book as a, quote, great entrepreneurial reporting accomplishment. Tall words there. Tell us why.
Well, a lot of people have written about North Korea from the vantage point of, say, 30,000 feet, describing the darkness in the country, both spiritual darkness and literally darkness. Only in Pyongyang can you see some lights at night because it is a society that's just suffering in so many ways. So to actually do it at street level with human interest and specific detail, it's a high degree of difficulty, like an Olympic dive with 3.5 twists in the tuck position. Melanie interviewed more than 200 people. A lot of them not easy to find because often they seek anonymity, but she kept at it, dug it out, and tell their stories.
As you mentioned, she collected the stories of those who escaped North Korea and the people who helped them escape and interviewed more than 200 people. That's a lot of material. What stood out to you in this interview?
Well, the story that got to me the most was the story of Mary and Jim, a Christian Korean-American couple from the Midwest. Their kids had graduated from college. They're doing well. They could have started pointing towards retirement. But instead, they move to northeastern China, and they start orphanages. And that's crucial because if a child has a Korean mom and a Chinese dad, the Chinese dads often reject the children. And then on the other side, the North Koreans, if the child has the Chinese father, a Korean mother, then they will sometimes murder the Chinese-fathered babies so as to protect North Korean pure blood. So a lot of racism to go around from both sides. And here this Korean-American couple, Christians Mary and Jim, they uproot their lives to make a huge difference in keeping these babies alive.
That's an inspiring story. How did Kirkpatrick become a North Korea expert?
The subtitle of her book is The Untold Story of Asia's Underground Railroad. And Melanie knew the history of the Underground Railroad in the U.S. before the Civil War, the way people could leave slavery and head north. And because there was a Fugitive Slave Act, there were people who would help them all the way to go to Canada, where they're out of the reach of Southern slave chasers. So she knew that history, and she had heard a lot about North Korea, and she just wanted to tell this untold story. It wasn't going to a university and sitting in a classroom. She read, she kept at it, she interviewed lots of people, she traveled, and she was able to tell all these really amazing and enlightening stories of self-sacrificing people to help Koreans escape, and then how they were able to often get to South Korea and put together new lives there. So it's an inspiring story, great factual accuracy, and she just kept at it because she was determined to do it. That's what's inspiring about journalism. When someone hears something that's important, really dives into it, and just keeps at it year after year until she gets to the heart of the story, and that's exactly what Melanie did.
At the time of this interview, which was 2012, Kirkpatrick estimated that 24,000 people had escaped North Korea since 1953. Any update on that number or any other pertinent developments related to North Korea?
Well, lots of guesstimates. In 2017, there were 31,000 people from North Korea who were registered with South Korea's Unification Ministry. And then there were at least 9,000 in China and maybe others in other places. So the numbers I've heard range all the way from, say, 40,000 until, well, I saw one estimate, 100,000. Hard to know because when people escape, sometimes their families are still in North Korea. They don't want to be known. They don't want to come forward. They just want to try to build a life blending in into South Korea. So that's the sad story. North Korea, after being in the news a lot during the first year or two of the Trump administration, has been pretty much out of it. But they're apparently continuing their armaments program, taking money from the poor to pour into nuclear weapons. And it'll probably be big time on the agenda again during the first couple of years of the Biden administration.
Marvin Olasky is editor-in-chief at World and the author of more than 20 books. Marvin, thanks for that insight.
Thank you, Jill.
In just a moment, Marvin Olasky's 2012 interview with author and journalist Melanie Kirkpatrick. This interview took place in front of an audience at Patrick Henry College.
The Olasky Interview Podcast is made possible by listeners like you. Additional support comes from Samaritan Ministries, a biblical solution to healthcare, where members live out Galatians 6:2 by bearing one another's burdens through prayer and financial support when there's a medical need. More at SamaritanMinistries.org/worldpodcast.
Well, thank you all for coming. And I want to say first, and this isn't something I say all that much, I mean, this is a terrific book. It is a wonderful job of reporting because it tells a story that most of us are not very familiar with at all. People have said that if you fly over around the world, I mean, you'll see lights all over the place. You won't see much in North Korea. So, Melanie, maybe you could just start by telling us a little bit about what that society is like and the information blackout that folks there have.
North Korea, you're right, Marvin, is unlike any other place in the world. There's a famous satellite image of it that shows the Korean Peninsula at night. South Korea is filled with bright lights up and down its half of the peninsula. And in North Korea, there's a little bit of light around Pyongyang, but the rest is black. When I interviewed a North Korean who had escaped, she was living in Rochester, New York, of all places, and a quiet, small city in America. I asked her if there was anything she missed, and her answer was the darkness. She was so used to being in the dark that the big lights of Rochester, New York, were a little overwhelming to her.
And it's not just the dark as far as electricity. We are wired right now. I mean, we all are used to, whether through iPads or computers, whatever, a click, two clicks, and we can find out to some extent what's going on in other parts of the world. What do people in North Korea know about what's going on in the rest of the world?
North Korea is a truly sealed society. The every communist regime, every totalitarian regime wants to control information, and because knowledge is power. But North Korea has, the Kim family regime has been able to take that to a new extreme. And there's very little information that gets in or has gotten in or out of North Korea until recently. And this is one of the things I write about in Escape from North Korea, is the impact that the people who have escaped have had on the friends and family they've left behind. In North Korea today, you can't make a phone call outside the country. You can't send a letter. You can't have access to the internet. You can't go on Facebook. There's no way for somebody from North Korea to communicate with the outside world. However, because of the people who've escaped, stories have gotten in to North Korea about the rest of the world, and people are beginning to wake up.
Now, the title of this, again, Escape from North Korea, but the subtitle, The Untold Story of Asia's Underground Railroad. Now, that's an expression, Underground Railroad, that resonates powerfully in American history. Mm-hmm. I suspect most of you are familiar with the Underground Railroad that existed in the mid-19th century to help escape slaves make their way to Canada. What's the Underground Railroad in Asia?
The Underground Railroad in Asia begins in northeast China near the border with North Korea. And the term was coined by some Christian rescuers in the late 1990s and early 2000s, who decided that they wanted to model their rescue attempts on the Underground Railroad in the antebellum South in America. And it's very similar to the original Underground Railroad in that it's a network of safe houses and secret transit routes that help people get across China. Now, you would think that if you wanted to go from Northeast China next to North Korea to South Korea, all you would do is go south to South Korea, if you're in North Korea, go south. You can't do that because of the DMZ, the demilitarized zone that separates the two countries. At the end of the Korean War in 1953, the DMZ was set up, and it is now called the world's most militarized border. And there's no way that people can get across that border. It's heavily fortified. So instead, North Koreans go north, they go to China, and then in China, they hook up often with a local Christian community. And eventually, they may get access to the Underground Railroad, and they go all the way across China, usually to a Southeast Asian country such as Thailand or Laos or Vietnam, sometimes north to Mongolia. And from there, they will head to the South Korean embassy and ask for the help of the South Koreans, who will then, if all goes well, help them get to South Korea.
Now, besides being blocked from the rest of the world as far as information, that doesn't seem pleasant, but it's not something by itself that might lead people to want to risk their lives to escape. What really propels people to try to get out from North Korea?
There's several reasons. In the late 1990s, there was a famine in North Korea, and about a tenth of the population died. And many people fled across the border to China seeking food or seeking jobs. And at the height of the aftermath of the famine, probably the late 90s, early 2000s, they were estimated to be about 500,000 North Koreans hiding in China. So that's one group of people, people who are seeking food. A lot of people, though, go there to seek food or work, and then they get to China and they see the relative freedoms that are offered to them there, and they make the decision to go to South Korea. Another group of people who leave are real defectors. They're people who are carrying with them state secrets or maybe are professionally trained and they want to get out. There was a classical pianist who I interviewed who had escaped, and he escaped because he wanted to play jazz, and jazz is forbidden in North Korea. As you can imagine, jazz is a very independent-minded, free-flowing kind of music. And the government does not like anything that encourages independent thought, so jazz is taboo.
So to get then out of North Korea going north, they have to cross a river into China. But it's not just the river that's the obstacle. There are other obstacles, right?
Yes. The river is an obstacle for many because most North Koreans can't swim. So they'll wait for winter when they can walk across the river, or in parts of the summer it might dry up so they can wade across. But that's not the real deterrent. The real deterrent is the North Korean border guards, who do not hesitate to shoot people in the back as they're crossing the border. And I can't tell you the number of refugees I've interviewed who said they were so scared that they were going to be shot as they were making a dash for freedom.
Any sense of what percentage of the people who try to escape that way actually make it?
No, I have no idea. It's just impossible to tell. And you have to remember that people escape several times. Mm-hmm. One thing I should have mentioned earlier is that China's policy, in contravention of its obligations under international law, China's policy is to track down North Koreans, arrest them, and send them back to North Korea, where they're treated very harshly. But incredibly, people will escape several times before they finally reach the Underground Railroad and then make it to safety in the West.
And so, as people, let's say, if they've gotten across the river, they've avoided being shot by the border guards or gone over landmines or other types of things there, they're in China. What's the piece of advice that lots of people are given? What's the first thing they look for?
I've heard this from so many people. The first thing they're told is look for a building with a cross on it. Church people will help North Koreans. And as one boy I interviewed said to me, as he told his story, I had to ask the old lady who told me this, I said to her, what's a church? And he had never heard of a church. But he found a building with a cross on it. He got help from the pastor who directed him to a church in another city where he could get help. And that started him, it hooked him up with a network which started him on a path to freedom.
And the people who offer help, they're jeopardizing a lot themselves.
Very much so. As I mentioned, it's against the law in China to help a North Korean. And the one community in China who seems willing to help them are Christians. Along the border area, border with North Korea in China, there are a number of ethnically Korean people. Korean Chinese are one of China's official 55 minorities. And many of those people are Christians. Christian missionaries were very effective in the Korean Peninsula and in this area called Manchuria in now northeast China in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. Billy Graham's wife, for example, was a medical missionary in what is now North Korea and China, and she grew up there. There is a Christian community still in the northeastern part of China, and they can be arrested for helping a North Korean. Even giving somebody a meal is against the law. So what these churches and what the Christian individuals do will help people kind of reach the next leg of find a bigger church or find a perhaps a South Korean or American group that might help them. But they're more likely to provide incidental help than permanent help.
Okay, so tell us about some of the next legs. If they've succeeded in getting across the river, if they have found a church or some Christian couple that will help them, what do they typically do next?
Typically, they'll hide out in China for a number, it could be many years. There are kind of two patterns nowadays. It used to be that North Koreans who got to China generally stayed there for quite a while before they made the decision to move on to South Korea. Because you have to remember, they would reach China with the image of South Korea or America or the West in their mind, the only image that they'd grown up with, and they thought of it as a terrifying place. And it would take a while for them to realize that South Korea was very different from what they've been told. So they might stay in China for several years. A number of refugees who got out had the experience of being arrested and sent back to North Korea and then having to escape a second time or even a third time before they got out. Another route now is that people who have escaped will sometimes hire couriers and brokers to help their families get out of North Korea, and then they leave China rather quickly. They just kind of pass through China. But the process can take years, or it could be a lot quicker. But more typical is that somebody will stay in China for a couple of years before he decides he wants to go to another country.
And then exit routes might be Laos, Thailand.
The exit routes are typically in the far west of China, you know, where it borders Southeast Asian countries. The nearest city is Kunming in Yunnan province. And from Kunming, they will probably walk across the border, often into Laos, sometimes into Burma, sometimes into Vietnam. It's the Golden Triangle area where opium has been smuggled for many years, and the human trafficking routes are very similar. And once they get to one of those countries, then they have to get to a South Korean consulate or a South Korean embassy.
And what's the attitude of South Korea towards the escapees?
South Korea's attitude has changed. The current president, Lee Myung-bak, took office in 2008, and he brought with him a very principled and moral attitude toward the refugees, in my mind. And under his administration, the South Korean facilities overseas have been told to accept any refugee who knocks on their door. Prior to that, however, were what a lot of people who help refugees referred to as the lost decade. This was the period when Kim Dae-jung and his successor were president. It was known as the years of the Sunshine Policy, and the South Korean government's official policy was to try to work with Pyongyang for more engagement with Pyongyang. And the government didn't want to talk about the people who escaped or didn't want to help them because it was afraid that it would annoy Pyongyang and ruin, blow up their engagement policy. So the embassies and consulates were not hugely helpful. Of course, they still did help sometimes. And there were other problems, too. For example, in one of the consulates that South Korea has in China, they had to close in the early 2000s. They had to close down the consulate for a couple of weeks because there were so many refugees trying to get in. They just closed the doors. Said, we can't take anymore.
So tell us a little bit about numbers. Do we have a sense of how many actually escape in the course of a year? Roughly?
In recent years, about 3,000 have reached South Korea every year. South Korea keeps close track of this. And it doesn't sound like a lot, but let me give you some figures by way of comparison. 20 years ago, 9 people got out. In 1992, 9 people reached South Korea. In 2002, I think the number was 153. And by 2008, the number was up around 2,000. Now it's about 3,000 a year.
Okay. And I've read that they're in North Korea, they're having big famine problems again. I mean, this is pretty customary, but even more than usual. And that would tend to indicate that there'll be more people facing a choice of either starvation or escape, who will try to escape.
It could indicate that, except for one factor, which is Kim Jong-un, the new leader, the new dictator of North Korea, who took office in December when Kim Jong-il died. He has issued a crackdown order along the border, and the word from my sources in South Korea and along the border is that fewer people are getting out. And in fact, in the first half of this year, about half as many people reached South Korea as did over the same time period last year.
Okay. So doesn't seem that we can expect things to get much better from any internal changes in the North Korean government.
There's been a number of commentators in recent months who have said it looks like change is finally coming to North Korea. But, you know, I've been covering this story for so many years. I've heard this so many times, and I'm highly skeptical.
So there are a couple of things that Americans concerned about this can do. And you tell stories about some who have really become personally involved. Mary and Jim,
yes.
That couple. Maybe you can tell folks about them.
Mary and Jim, those are pseudonyms, is an American couple from the Midwest. And their kids have graduated from college. They both have had successful careers. And a few years ago, they decided that they wanted to devote the rest of their lives to helping people. They are devout Christians. And their first thought was to go to Africa. And then they got thinking about it. They're Korean-American. They speak Korean. And they said, well, we should go to China. And they made the decision to go to China. Their church and the organization they work for, Crossing Borders, supported them. And today they run a string of orphanages in northeast China for the children of Chinese men and North Korean women who have been sold as brides to Chinese men, and also for some 100% North Korean children. And they also have one shelter for young women who are in danger of being sold as brides.
And the children from parents, one Chinese, one North Korean, are usually considered in China to be impure?
Yes. It's a very sad situation. I refer to these children as half and half children. And they're rejected by both countries. Let me give you a little bit of background. When China arrests a North Korean woman and sends her back to North Korea, if she's pregnant, the North Korean policy is to abort the baby because she is carrying Chinese seed, which is considered impure. They want their children to be purely Korean. The methods of abortion are so horrible, I can't really even bring myself to talk about them. But this just gives you an idea of the attitude of the North Koreans. The Chinese are also racist, I must say, and their attitude toward North Koreans is very derisive, very derogatory. They do not like them. And so these kids are rejected. Often, if the mother leaves, and mothers do leave on the Underground Railroad and leave their children behind, the fathers often reject them because they're impure. Some fathers care about their children, though, and feel that they would be better off in one of these orphanages run by Christians. And I'd like to say one other word about the orphanages. Mary and Jim are heroic figures in my book. I admire them enormously. But the foster parents who run these orphanages are taking even greater risks. They're Chinese citizens, and if they're caught taking care of these kids and proselytizing, the children are all raised in Christian homes, and proselytizing is against the law in China, they could face severe repercussions.
So there's that aspect of it involving orphanages and forced abortions and so forth. Another aspect, I know a lot of students are interested in sex trafficking and in fighting against that. And so there's that element of it, because China's one-child policy has led to many fewer female babies than male babies.
Yes.
And tell us how that fits
in. Yes, in northeast China in particular, in the area that borders North Korea, there is a severe shortage of young women due to the one-child policy that's been in effect now for over 30 years. And these men are desperate for brides. The British Medical Journal has done a study and said that it looks like the ratio in northeast China, in some areas, of men to women is an amazing 14 to 1. So that gives you just an idea of how desperate some of these men are. And so they buy brides from North Korea. And sometimes the women are complicit. They know what they're doing, but they're desperate too. Imagine yourself a young woman in China. If you're a North Korean woman and you've crossed into China and you can't speak the language, you know that if you operate in the open, like try to get a job, in a real job, you'll be arrested and sent back to North Korea, where you'll be thrown into a prison camp and very brutally treated. So when given the option of marrying, quote unquote, because these marriages are not official, marrying a Chinese man, you might take it. Other women are tricked into going across the border, and they discover that they've been sold. And it's, you know, some of these marriages work out, and it's hard to say, but they're could be, as you know, there could be tens of thousands of women hiding, you know, married, quote unquote, to Chinese men and living happily, you know, or at least satisfactorily in China. But many of them, these marriages, you know, are hellholes for the women, and the women try to get out on the Underground Railroad. And one other thing, just since you mentioned human trafficking, there's also a porn industry in China, of course, and sometimes these North Korean women are pressed into either brothels or into online pornography.
So besides going there and helping with the Underground Railroad or developing orphanages or fighting sex trafficking, what can individual Americans do? And let me be more specific, of individual American Christians.
I think the first very basic requirement, if we're going to help these people, is to educate more Americans that this problem exists. When I started to research the book and friends or family would ask me what I was going to write about, I would tell them about the Underground Railroad, and they didn't know about it. There were two exceptions to that. Occasionally, I'd meet a foreign policy wonk whose specialty was China, and he had heard of it because it's a public policy issue in China. The other group were evangelicals, and I ran across a number of evangelicals who were aware of the issue. But as a matter of general observation, I would say almost nobody has heard of this. There's a group called Liberty in North Korea, or LINK, run out of Torrance, California. It is a secular group, but most of the people who are part of it are Christian and are motivated to help because of their Christian beliefs. And they raise awareness, and they also have a program that aims to bring 100 people out of China every year to safety. If you're interested, I would urge you to get involved with LINK.
What should American policy be towards North Korea in a way that can actually help the people of North Korea?
I think we need to bring the issue of human rights into our dealings with North Korea. Right now, human rights, if they're raised, are raised very quietly. They're totally subordinate to all the other issues, specifically the nuclear issue. Think about the Soviet Union. We always talked to the Soviet Union and made demands on human rights issues. We don't do the same with North Korea, and I think we should. I also think, and this is probably a bridge too far for any administration, I also think our policy should be the bringing down the Kim family regime and the peaceful reunification of the Koreas under a free and democratic system.
Please join me in thanking Melanie Kirkpatrick for writing a wonderful book.
That was Marvin Olasky's 2012 interview with author and journalist Melanie Kirkpatrick. If you like this podcast, don't forget to subscribe, share it with your friends, and rate it on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. I'm Jill Nelson. Thanks for listening.
Additional support comes from Samaritan Ministries, a community of Christians who, through prayer, encouragement, and financial support, will care for you when you have a medical need. When the body of Christ comes together to provide for one another, burdens are lifted and God is glorified. This applies to all areas of life, including healthcare. More at SamaritanMinistries.org/worldpodcast.